that really takes up three parshiyos. Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash. It's a very, very long story. It is the story of Mashiach Yosef. And Yaakov Avinu comes back to Eretz Yisrael. He had his encounter with Esav. As we talked about last week, this is the prototype of the conflict that Bnei Yisrael have with the Umos HaOlam. And Yaakov had to prepare a whole variety of strategies. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Yaakov Avinu triumph, and his name was changed from Yaakov to Yisrael. Instead of being the heel, he is now the one that is able to successfully vanquish enemies who try to destroy Torah and Kedusha in the world. And then the pasuk begins, Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Aviv. Yaakov finally settles in the ancestral home of Eretz Yisrael. And Rashi points out that Vayeshev doesn't just mean physically living, but you know, you want to settle down. He had turbulence at Laban's house, and then he meets Esav. So finally, Bikesh Yaakov Leishev V'Shalva. Yaakov wanted to live in peace and tranquility. But tzaddikim in this world do not get peace and tranquility. Rather, he indeed deals with the whole story of Mechivas Yosef. Now, in many ways, why Mechivas Yosef occurred is very hard for us to understand. And indeed, no matter what you say, there is absolutely going to be no particular explanation. Because you're still going to say, how could it be? How could it be? How could it be? How could the brothers, all of whom are called tzaddikim, how could they take their brother and sell him into slavery? They actually wanted to kill him, and then they sold him into slavery. But we'll take it a little bit at a time. First, we are told that when Yosef was 17 years old, so he was a young man who was taking care of sheep, and the pasuk says, "V'yave Yosef es dibasam ra el aviyam." Yosef brought lashon hara about his brothers to his father. He would tell his father bad stories about the brothers. We have to assume that Yosef wasn't lying, but what exactly was the content of the Yetzer, of the Lashon Hara? So the Gemara says in Chulin that he accused his brothers of two things. The first thing he accused his brothers was eating Eber Menachai. They were eating a limb that was severed from an animal that's alive. The animal's alive, you cut off the leg. That's called Eber Menachai. That is usher for Jews, and it's even usher for Goyim, because it's one of the Sheva Mitzvot from your Noah. And Yosef told Yaakov that the brothers are nichshal in Eber Menachai. The other thing they said was, or he said was, they were mezalzel b'vnei hashvachas, that the children of Leah, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, they were mezalzel. They treated the children of the maidservants, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, in a disrespectful way, and that was it. The brothers, as a result, were very jealous. They were jealous both because of Yosef bringing Lashon Hara and because of the fact that Yaakov loved Rachel more than Leah, and Mela that carried over to Yosef as well. So the emphasis is, there's a very, very famous drasha from the Mishnah. The Mishnah Melech is known as the commentary on the Rambam, but he wrote, or at least after his death it was compiled, various lengthy drushas on Inyanim of Chumash called the Prashas Derachim. And it's kind of a style of interpretation that takes the details of halakha and tries to read them into the Pesukim. And he wants to say like this: how could the brothers be Eiver and Eiver Menachai? How is that Shaykh? And if Yosef is lying, how could Yosef lie? So what's going on here? Is Yosef lying and the brothers didn't eat Eiver Menachai? Or is Yosef telling the truth and the brothers did eat Eiver Menachai? You've got a problem either way. So the Precious Drachim wants to say that there's a fundamental machlokes Yosef and his brothers. What is the status of the Jewish nation before the giving of the Torah? Because on one end, we know that there are the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, which Goyim have to keep. And then we know there is the Torah, which Am Yisrael has to keep. We also know that the Avos, through Ruach HaKodesh, kept the whole Torah even before it was given. But the question is, do they have the right to do that if that's going to be a leniency? Meaning, if they want to be machmir on themselves, they could be machmir. but they wouldn't be permitted to leave the Noahide laws in a lenient basis. In other words, if you can identify a situation where under the B'nai Noach the law would be more chomer than under the Torah, the fact that they want to keep the Torah could not possibly exempt them from the Noahide law. Or do I say, once they've accepted the Torah, they're Yetzei Lagamri from the Dinei B'nai Noach. Now, most of the time, this is not going to be a relevant shaila, because in 99 out of 100 times, the Torah's laws are stricter than the Noahide laws. So if they've accepted the Torah, they certainly will not violate the Noahide laws. Right? The Noahide laws are fewer, and everything in the Noahide law is already included in the Torah, with many more things. But the precious Drosan points out, there's a very interesting difference in the Noahide law regarding the definition of Eber Menachai. Let's say you have a cow or a sheep, and you shecht the cow or the sheep. And after you shecht it, it's still convulsing. There is still neurological activity. It is still convulsing. And you were to cut off a piece of meat. Would you be allowed to eat that piece of meat, or would that still be called Eber Menachai? Now, here's what the Gemara in Chulin says. It's a tiny bit complicated. The Isser of Eber Menachai applies to Jews and non-Jews. But the definition of Eber Menachai will differ between Jews and non-Jews. Since Jews have a mitzvah of shechita, as soon as an animal is shechted, it is halachically dead, even if there is still convulsive movements. So under Jewish law, if I cut off meat from an animal after it was shechted while it's still convulsing, it is not Eber Menachai, it is meat from a shechted animal. But under the Noahide code, since under the laws of Ben Noach, Shechita is not a particular mitzvah, so it's called Eber Menachai until it's dead. And it's not dead until it stops moving. So the precious Drachim wants to say that both Yosef and his brothers are correct. The brothers would slaughter an animal, and they would cut off the meat while it was still convulsing, if they wanted fresh meat. Their shita was that because they accepted the Torah via the Avos, they are totally no longer in the category of B'nai Noach. If they're no longer in the category of B'nai Noach, they are entitled to apply the Jewish definition of Eber Menachai, which means once the animal is shechted, it is considered to be dead. So according to their shita, it was not Eber Menachai. Their understanding of their relationship with God actually said it was permitted. But Yosef maintained a different halachic position. He maintained the Torah wasn't given yet. You're assuming the Torah as an optional observance because of your Ruach HaKodesh or because of the Ruach HaKodesh of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but that doesn't allow you to take on the leniencies of halacha. You can only take on the stringencies of halacha. So vis-a-vis Eber Menachai, you still have to follow the Noahide law. And if you have to follow the Noahide law, then even after it's shechted and it's convulsing, it is still considered alive, and there's an issue of Eber Menachai. So this is a beautiful, albeit complicated explanation, where, according to the brothers, they were halachically permitted to eat what they're eating. According to Yosef, it was forbidden, and Yosef brings it to Yaakov. How did Yaakov pass them? We really don't know. We really don't know what was Yaakov Avinu's own response to this Lashon Hara that Yosef brought. This is a famous, famous thought from the Precious Drachim, which is the Mishnah Melech, and this is his springboard for a whole long essay, whether B'nai Yisrael before Matan Torah left the category of Noahides only to be Machmir, or they left the category of Noahides even to be Maker. Another example where this comes up, again, we may have mentioned this, you may have heard it, is the issue of how could the Avos keep Shabbos? We could say they accepted the Torah, they kept Shabbos. But the problem is, a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. We have a klal that says, Goy Shabbos. If a non-Jew keeps Shabbos, the non-Jew is deserving of death because Shabbos was given only to Am Yisrael. So once again, like the brothers, there would be no problem because the brothers say, we are now Klal Yisrael. We are not governed by the Noahide law. But according to Yosef Shita, how would it be shaykh for them to keep Shabbos? They're not allowed to be mekel. If something is forbidden for the Noahites, they're not allowed to be mekel. So how could the Avos keep Shabbos based on the understanding that they still have Dinei B'nei Noach L'chumra, even though they took on Dinei Yisrael L'chumra? But they can't take on the status of Am Yisrael to be mekel. Right? So how could Avraham Avinu or any of the Avos or the Shvatim, how could they keep Shabbos? So for that, they already give a number of answers. One answer is that some say we bring the future written, is that Avraham Avinu did something that would be called Shabbos desecration for a guy, and it wouldn't be called Shabbos desecration for a Jew. So he kept the Shabbos of a Jew, and he violated the Shabbos of a guy. What would that be? He says he wore tzitzis. Because if a guy wears tzitzis on Shabbos, since a guy does not have a mitzvah of tzitzis, these tzitzis are not part of a garment. So if a guy walks outside without an Erev, he is desecrating Shabbos, which for a guy is good. He's supposed to desecrate Shabbos. On the other hand, for a Jew, since there's a mitzvah of tzitzis, if it's kosher tzitzis, it's called part of the garment. So just like any clothing you wear, you're not mechal Shabbos. So Avraham Avinu kept Shabbos from the perspective of his Jewish identity, and he violated Shabbos from the perspective of his non-Jewish identity. So he both fulfilled the Noahide law, that you can't keep Shabbos, and he fulfilled the Jewish law, that you should keep Shabbos. Right? So he did both at the same time, and this is what the Chassam Sefer brings. Of course, it's reminiscent of that story about a very from non-Jew who was studying to be a ger, to become a Jew. He was very, very stark. He was learning all day, very, very machmir and halacha. So one of his friends went over to him and said, you know, you think you're such a tzaddik. You know, I want you to know you're doing all sorts of things wrong, because I see you are medayek in all of Hilchos Shabbos, and you keep all of Hilchos Shabbos, and you probably think you're doing a great thing, but you know, you're not allowed to keep Shabbos. You have to be mechal Shabbos. So the person says, don't worry, I carry in the Erev. But the truth is, if a person is a non-Jew who is studying for conversion, he is obligated to do some malacha on Shabbos, turn on a bathroom light, do one thing that's obviously very usher on Shabbos, because otherwise he would be bichlal the rule of goy sheshavas chayav mitzvah. A goy is not allowed to keep Shabbos. Okay. Another answer they give, which is a little more complicated, from the Hafla, who was the Chassam Sefer's Rebbe, in other words, how could Avraham keep Shabbos if non-Jews are not supposed to keep Shabbos? And they say that the definition of when a day starts differs for goyim and Jews. For Jews, we know our day starts at night. So Shabbos is Friday night and Shabbos. Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker. But the Hafla wants to show that for non-Jews, the definition of a day is morning followed by night. So the Hafla wants to say, therefore, that the period that is called Shabbos for non-Jews is Saturday day and Saturday night. The period that is called Shabbos for Jews is, of course, Friday night and Saturday day. So Avraham Avinu made sure to do malacha Saturday night. So he violated the non-Jewish definition of Shabbos while he kept the Jewish definition of Shabbos. That's what that law wants to say. Again, it's a very short teretz, actually. I mean, it's a very difficult teretz. And the reason it's difficult is that the aside of why a guy doesn't keep Shabbos is that Shabbos was given to the Jewish people. So it's difficult to say that the definition of what a goy can't keep is going to be different than what a Jew is supposed to keep. On the other hand, this itself could be a simple answer. That is, the iser of a goy keeping Shabbos is because he's taking it away from the Jewish people. So if that's the case, how is it possible to say that if a Jewish person keeps Shabbat? In other words, like this. Even if the Torah wasn't given yet, but who is Abraham taking Shabbos away from? Himself? In other words, it's not shayach to talk about, oh, you're robbing Shabbos from the Jewish people if the Jewish people come from you. So I mean, that would be another answer to that question. But being as it may, this is, if you're ever interested, you pick up the Sefer, Prusha Struchen, it's a bit of an advanced Sefer, you will see a long 30, 40 pages discussion of whether B'nai Yisrael, before Matan Torah, they leave the category of B'nai Noach only for the stringencies, or they leave the category of B'nai Noach even that they could be Mekel, and they don't have to have the chumras of the non-Jew. And this is how he learns the debate of Mefarcheses, a convulsing animal that was shechted. It is still Eiver Menachai under the Noachide law, and it is not Eiver Menachai under the Jewish law. And the brothers maintained that they are Jews even to be lenient. And Yosef says you can be Jews only to be Machmer, but you still have to stick with the stringency of this law. Okay. But be it as it may, even if Yosef said pure Lashon Hara on them, what exactly is their cheshbon of getting rid of him? So B'kitzer, there is an important yisoid that the Sephorno says. The Sephorno says that the father, the brothers had seen a certain pattern in the history of this family. They had seen that Avraham Avinu had two sons, a Yitzchak and a Yishmael. And Yishmael was sent away. And the heritage of the covenant with Hashem was passed down to Yitzchak, not to Yishmael. Ki be Yitzchak yikara l'chazara. Through Yitzchak, you shall have a child. And Yitzchak and Rivka have twins, Yaakov and Esav. And they're twins. They actually come from the same mother and the same father. And Esav gets sent away. And the bris and the covenant is with only Yaakov. And now Yaakov has many children, but the brothers see that Yaakov loves the child of Rachel and Binyamin more than the other children. They see that Yosef is pointing out that the brothers might be guilty of different averos, whether it's halachically true or not, but that is what Yosef is pointing out. So what they see is they see a repetition of the pattern that is driving a wedge between Yaakov and them. And they are fearful that is what is going to happen is that they will be expelled from the spiritual heritage of Am Yisrael. And Am Yisrael will be created only through the children of Rachel, especially since the argument could be made that the whole marriage to Leah was a mistake. The whole marriage to Leah was unintentional. Yes, Leah had six children, okay. But Kedushin Batais, right? Did you study Kedushin Batais? A Kedushin that was made under a mistake. In fact, even halachically, the whole question, why was Yaakov even married to Leah if Yaakov thought he was marrying Rachel? It shouldn't even be a good Kedushin. So the Sephorno says a very amazing idea, which it's hard to apply halachically. Since Chazal say, Gadol ha-machtiyo yesem in aharka, that if I cause somebody to sin, if I cause somebody to be estranged from God, that is even worse than killing. And kal v'chomer in this case, when it's not just that the brothers will be estranged, but this will be a permanent thing, that they're going to lose for eternity, they think, their chelek in Am Yisrael. And they're going to be relegated to another offshoot, like Yishmael, like Esav. They felt that Yosef was a rodef. What is a rodef? Somebody who is threatening your life. And what is the halacha? Somebody who is killing you, who's coming to kill you, you think is going to kill you. Hashkei v'harav lo. You are commanded to kill them first. They sat as a basin, and they actually paskened. Yosef is chayav misa, because he is cutting off our spiritual destiny to be part of the Jewish people. He deserves to die. And that is why initially, you'll recall, they did not initially say, let us sell Yosef into slavery. They initially said, let us kill him. They were actually going to kill him. Could we suspect that the Shiftei Kah would be murderers? So the Sephorno said, they sat as a basin, and they paskened that he was Chayav Misa as a Rodeh. Now you might ask, well, first of all, how could that be? Under the normal rules of any type of trial in Halacha, relatives can't paskin, right? So how could it be? Brothers could adjudicate. Once again, Lishitasim, it's very good, though, because they held that, like the precious Drachim, it's difficult, because if they are Lagamri like Yisrael, they're not allowed to follow Noachide laws. I was going to answer, under the laws of B'nai Noach, relatives can adjudicate and the like. On the other hand, it's almost inconsistent with them. Okay, that's a big problem. On the other hand, let me say, too, that the laws of Rodef don't require a basin. I mean, think about this. Let's talk about Rodef in a very narrow sense. I'm walking down a dark street, and God forbid, somebody pulls out a gun on me, and I happen to have a gun. I don't need to call the basin up and say, oh, am I allowed to shoot? That might be a little late. So Rodef, per se, doesn't require a basin. It just requires a decision that your life is being endangered. But the Kiddush of the Sephorno is that this type of spiritual endangerment would rise to the level of Rodef. Now, halachically, I think we'd be very reluctant to ever apply that. That would mean, if this guy is making me late for Seder, I can pull out a gun and kill him. we certainly wouldn't say that. So please do not quote me that I authorized anyone to do that. But this is different. This is not stamazai, the individual person not doing a mitzvah. This is cutting off their eternal connection with Am Yisrael. Now, if you remember, though, after they decided to kill him, so what does it then say? Reuven says, Lo nakenu nefesh. Let's not kill him. Reuven says, let's throw him into this pit, and no one should touch him. And Reuven's intention, of course, was that I'll come back after everybody goes, and I'll rescue him. But of course, what eventually happened was that when Reuven was gone, I will discuss later what Reuven was doing. Why was Reuven gone at the critical moment of the sale? Yosef was drawn out of the pit, and Yosef was sold into slavery. Now, the Orach Chaim, the very famous Orach Chaim, very controversial Orach Chaim, HaKadosh, discusses this issue. Originally, the brothers wanted to kill him. Reuven said, don't kill him, let's throw him into a pit. So here is the kasha. The Gemara says like this, what does it say about the pit? Harbor reik. The pit was empty. Ein bo mayim. There was no water in the pit. So the Gemara and Shabbos asked the obvious kasha, if the pit was empty, it didn't have water, why do you say, harbor reik, ein bo mayim? Gemara's answer is, there's a diuk. It didn't have water, but it had something else. It was a pit that was filled with snakes and scorpions. They threw Yosef into a pit that was filled with snakes and scorpions. Now, Gemara says in Yavamas that if a man falls into a pit that's filled with scorpions, and witnesses did not see whether he's dead or alive, but we know that there are a lot of scorpions in that pit, if we can testify he fell into the pit, his wife is allowed to marry, because the halacha says it's a 100% certainty. Halachically, we're allowed to assume that he's dead. So what is Reuven's cheshbon here? Reuven's cheshbon is, let's not kill him, let's throw him into a pit of snakes and scorpions. Why is that any better? That's certainly going to kill him. You might say it didn't, but as far as Yosef was concerned, it would have killed him. So how could Reuven have a havamina that throwing him into a pit of snakes and scorpions is any better? So there's a vort from the Vilna Gaon, which it's hard to understand how this. This is what he says. He says, well, Maybe we can answer it this way. The pasuk says, "V'yashlichu loso babor." They threw him into a pit. And the Gra quotes a Gemara in Talmud that says that whenever you use the word hashlacha, it is always at a distance of 20 amos or more. That's 40 feet. Right? So if we accept that the pit was 40 feet deep, and then we have another Gemara that says a sukkah, remember a sukkah, the schach of a sukkah, cannot be more than 20 amos high, because a person walking would not see it with his eyes. So the Gra wants to say that the reason Reuben threw him into such a bore is because the bore was so deep that Reuben could not see the snakes or the scorpions. This is what the Vilna Gaon says. But this is a very schwer Gra for a lot of reasons. First of all, if the pit is 40 feet deep, and you throw somebody into a 40-foot, so even if there are no stakes in scorpions, he's normally going to get killed. In fact, the Gemara says, if a pit is only 10 tefachim, it's only 40 inches, that is enough to kill a person. And that's indeed difficult to understand, but rest assured, 40 feet can certainly kill a person. Second of all, the rule in the Gemara that you don't see things that are more than 20 amos high, that applies when I'm walking in the street and I'm looking straight ahead. If I look up, I can see. And if I look down, I can see. Now, it could be, if I look down into a pit, I'm not going to see the snakes and scorpions because it's dark. But that has no shaykhus to the rule of the 20 amos. The 20 amos rule is not a rule that when I'm looking straight ahead, my I don't know if they call it peripheral vision, but whatever your vision is above your head is called, when I'm looking straight ahead, my eyes will only pick up less under 20 amos. But that has no shaykhus to when I'm directly looking. So the Vilna Gaon's teretz is very shver, both because if Reuven knew that the boar is 20 amos deep, it wouldn't make sense to Shitaso to throw Yosef in. And if he looked, he would be able to see the snakes and scorpions, except if it was dark, and that has nothing to do with the 20 amos. But okay. But you could say, I mean, I'll pee the derech of the Gra, and someone say, well, Reuven didn't know there were snakes and scorpions, he didn't know it was deep, he didn't know there were snakes and scorpions, etc. But the Ora Chaim HaKadosh gives a very radical answer, a radical, radical answer that is complicated and disturbing, in other words, in terms of its assumptions. And he says the following. The brothers declare that Yosef is Chayev Misa, because he's a Raideth. So here is Reuven's taina. Maybe we're right, and maybe we're wrong. Maybe we are objectively assessing the situation correctly, but maybe we're acting out of jealousy or hatred. How do we know we're right? How do we know that Yosef is Chayev Misa? Or maybe the other way around. We are murderers who are killing an innocent man. Now, if we kill him, this is the Archaim's case, if we go ahead and kill him, we have no guarantee that we are acting correctly, because this is what the Archaim says. Because human beings are given free will, it is possible for a human being to take a life, even if God has not decreed that that person deserves to die. So if we kill Yosef, we cannot infer that Yosef deserved to die, because even if Yosef didn't deserve to die, he might be victimized by our Bechira, in which the Ora Chaim says, Bechira can hurt a person, even if it was not the will of God. In other words, God, as it were, lets Bechira have that reign. In many ways, the Ora Chaim gives an answer, a partial answer, to how could righteous people, you know, suffer at the hands of evildoers. The Ora Chaim says, sometimes it is the fallout of the Bechira Chafshis of Rishon. But, says Reuven, listen to this, says Reuven, if you really want to know if Yosef is deserving of death, I'll give you a test. Let's throw him into a pit of snakes and scorpions. The Ora Chaim says, an animal cannot harm a human because animals don't have free will. An animal cannot harm a human being unless the human being is chayav misa. A person can harm a human being even if that human being is not chayav misa. So Reuben said, I don't trust what we do to show that Yosef is chayav misa. But throw him to the snakes. If they kill him, he must have been chayav misa. If he doesn't deserve death, they won't kill him. Now again, do not try this at home. Don't try to test your righteousness by jumping into a lion's den or whatever it is. But this is the big chiddush of the Or HaChaim. Now, the amazing thing is, therefore, Yosef was a beneficiary of an absolute miracle. He was thrown into a pit of snakes and scorpions. He emerged unscathed, and they still sold him. That's pretty amazing. Because if the whole idea was, if they don't kill him, that's a proof that he's innocent. So what did the brothers do again? It's like saying, well, af al pi chen. So that shows you how deep a person's bias can be. That's, even though there was a literal miracle done to Yosef, he still did not accept that and said they sold him into slavery. Okay? Now, again, the Or HaChaim's point, I just want to point out, is disputed by many, many, many commentators and many, many swarm. In other words, the issue basically becomes this. To what degree do we say that everything that is done to me in my life was decreed by Hashem? In other words, we should really, just as representatives here, let's take the Chayvus HaLevavos, right? One of the most famous Musar Svarim, ethical swarm ever written is The Duties of the Heart, and this is from an early Rishon. This is from before the time of the Rambam. And the Chayvus HaLevavos makes the point that is said over many, many times by many, many Gedolim over centuries and centuries. There is nothing that happens to a person that is not specifically decreed by God. That if I stub my toe, if I hurt my finger, if I get caught in a traffic jam, if I'm on a bus for 20 extra minutes, if God forbid a person gets blown up, or if Baruch Hashem a person escapes, all of that is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu determined that that is what should happen to that person. We don't always know the reason. I'm not saying we know the reason, but everything is nigzer by Hashem. This is called Hashkacha Pratis. This is called specific divine intervention. Now, and the Chayvus HaLevavos therefore says that if somebody insults me, if somebody hurts me, even though Hashem is going to hold that person to account because they exercise bechira, it's very complicated. On one hand, he had free will. See, how do you understand the Chayvus HaLevavos for a moment? The Chayvus HaLevavos says that no person would die unless Hashem decreed that he would die. But the guy that pulled the trigger, that was his bechira. So what would be if he chose not to pull the trigger? So what would happen? The answer is, the building would have collapsed. The guy who got shot would have got a heart attack. In other words, it would have happened anyway, the Chayvus HaLevavos says. But Hashem is like a chess master. He uses the billions and billions of individual decisions people make, and he matches them up with the, as a shadchan, with the results that the Eibishter wants. So some guy decides he's going to shoot somebody tonight, the Eibishter will put in the store the person who is supposed to be the recipient of the bullet. If at the last minute the criminal does tshuva, then the Ribbono Shel Olam will have to cause an earthquake or a brick to fall or whatever. This is the Chayvus HaLevavos. And that's why the Chayvus HaLevavos says that although Hashem is never machriach the Rasha to do the Aveira, that's very important. And that's why the Rasha could be punished. But nothing could happen. The Rasha could not do anything to me unless Hashem decided I was chayav. Now again, that doesn't mean because of sins. Maybe I'm a kapara for the door. That could be a million reasons. But there's a direct gezeira. This is the view of the Chayvus HaLevavos, and I would have to say, although we don't necessarily decide this by mainstream views, this is the view that's commonly taught by most of the Bali Musar and in most of the yeshivas. But the Or HaChaim is a radically different view. The Or HaChaim is a radically different view. The Or HaChaim says that because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a world of free will, and free will is essential for the morality of reward and punishment, because without free will, how could I be rewarded for good that I do? I'm just programmed. And how could I be punished for evil? Free will is such a powerful principle that people can be swept up into the free will of others even without Hashem directly dictating. Now, people might ask me, Kasha, so what's the point of davening? In other words, like I said, we daven to Hashem, let's say, save me from the hand of the Russia. So like the Chovas HaLevavos, that's very understandable. Because the Russia will not be able to hurt me unless Hashem decrees that I deserve at this moment, for whatever reason, to get that punishment. So I pray to Hashem, show me mercy, give me rachamim. But like the Aruch Hayim, it's entirely possible that Hashem didn't decree that I should get hurt. I'm just within the person's free will. So what am I praying for? The answer is like this. The answer is, even like the Aruch Hayim, even though Hashem didn't decree that a person dies, but and it's the bechira of another person, but Hashem can rescue that from that bechira, right? Because Hashem could basically give you a special zechus not to be in that place, or Hashem could cause the bullet to miss, or Hashem could cause the bullet to hit the arm or the shoulder, where it wouldn't be so serious. In other words, you're not praying that Hashem should annul his decree, but you're praying that Hashem should intervene so I shouldn't be subject to his bechira. Okay? So this is a machlokes, and this is why the Aruch Hayim HaKadosh suggests that Reuven said, let's not kill him, let's throw him to the animals and see what the snakes and the scorpions do.
Does anybody ask on the Aruch Hayim that the brothers threw him in, which is an input of bechira? There's still an input of bechira because they chose to put him in that situation.
Yes. That's a good point. But again, you have to look at it that the Aruch Hayim is assuming that it's not the depth of the pit that would have killed him, because that would be from their bechira. It would simply be the attack of the snakes. And the snakes are not Barley bechira. Right? This is the famous note of the Aruch Hayim.
According to the opinion that says the brothers tried to kill Yosef because they were worried about their spiritual heritage, for Am Yisrael, could the same logic not then be applied to Yishmael and Esav's attempts to kill their brothers?
That's a very good point. It is a very good point. I think the difference would be that the choice of Yitzchak over Yishmael was confirmed by the Ribbono Shel Olam. So the Ribbono Shel Olam themselves. So obviously, if Rashi Baruch Hu says this is the choice, you can't contest it as a rodent. You can't say Hashem is a rodent, right? So consequently, the notion of killing because you don't like the choice that Hashem made is very different than feeling that Yosef is manipulating and creating his own choice.
On their din that Yosef was Chayav Misa, is it not possible? Is it halachically okay that half brothers can sit on a base then?
Halachically, no. No, certainly brothers from the father or from the mother cannot sit on any basis.
And also, according to this pattern of the favored son, shouldn't technically Binyamin be the favored son?
Yes, it's a good point. There are two answers I'll give you for it. One is that Binyamin was too young to be a leadership role at that point. So of the sons would be leaders, he made Joseph. The other is, and I didn't see this, but I think it makes sense just emotionally. Remember that Rachel died as she was giving birth to Binyamin. So one can imagine, Chas v'Shalom, when these things do happen, there's a little bit of a mixed feeling there, in the sense that this is the child who killed my wife. I don't want to ascribe that type of negativity to Yaakov directly. But that could be colored a little bit why Yosef would be more, perhaps more treacherous. Either because he was old enough to be a leader at this point, or because he was not associated with Rachel Emanu's death. Okay. All right, so anyway, be this may, this Arachon, as I say, is one of the most discussed aspects of how Hashgacha Pratis works in our life. Do I say that Hashem micromanages every detail of our life? Or do I say that sometimes we're just in the wrong place, the wrong time, and Hashem lets the bechira of other people affect us in different ways? And that's the big machlokas between the Chabas HaLevavos and the Orach Chaim. As they say, most of the Bali Musar and all of the Mekubalim all go with the idea of Hashgacha Pratis. Now people ask me, what's the halacha? So, which way do we postulate this? So listen, we're talking about how Hashem deals with us. So it's not really shayach for us to postulate a halacha. If Hashem does what he does, we're not always sure. But still, some Sforim do make a compromise position. They say that we follow the Chavos HaLevavos in Eretz Yisrael, and we follow the Orach Chaim in Chutz Loretz. That is, in Eretz Yisrael, there is a special, special level of Hashgacha Pratis, in which Hashem is involved in every single detail. Inei Hashem Elokecha Bar. So in that sense, people who live here a long time, they will testify that they feel in Eretz Yisrael. Now that doesn't mean things will be easy. Remember, Hashgacha Pratis doesn't mean, oh, life is so wonderful, every morning I have, $1 million in my bed. It could be very, very rough, but it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is directly involved in everything that happens. Okay?
Thank you.